Hello, good afternoon. We have a microphone here. My name is John Seddell, and I'm here to welcome you to our lecture, Worlding the Postcolonial, by Himity Mupidi of Vassar College. It should be noted that Himity is unusual in not relying on PowerPoint. And for those of you addicted to PowerPoint, I recommend there's a methadone clinic on Theobald's Road that you can go to afterwards. But you'll have to make it through the hour and a half twitching and drooling and struggling through it. But we are very fortunate to have Himadeep here. He is the author of three major books of interest to us in the study of international relations from different ways. We have his first book in 2004 with University Press, The Politics of the Global. Then in 2012, his books, The Colonial Signs of International Relations with Columbia University Press. And most recently, his book in 2014, The Politics of Motion, The Song of Telangana with Routledge, which has a very personal dimension to it in terms of his hometown and home state in India, alongside the broader international themes that are brought in. But today he's speaking to us in very broad, ambitious, and still ambiguous terms about worlding the postcolonial, so I'm curious to hear what he'll say. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, John. Thank you all for being here today. So, I woke up yesterday morning to an email from a friend telling me about the bombings recently in Ankara, Turkey. She recalled witnesses to the bombing talking somewhat incoherently of being doused in the immediate aftermath of the bombings, of being doused with the smell of burnt flesh, the smell of burned meat. I feel queasy, somewhat uneasy in the stomach, even as I grapple with this synesthetic image. To love the smell of meat, of grilled meat, and yet when that meat is us, our fellow human beings, what sort of intimacy is that? Partha Chatterjee, in his magisterial book, The Nation and Its Fragments, draws on an earlier invocation by Gyan Pandey of the idea of a fragment to expose, to puncture in different ways the shallowness of certain universals, like the nation, such as the nation. I, taking my turn, want to sharpen the fragment a bit, make it into a shard, something more pointed, maybe not much smaller and tinier than the one you have here. Something smaller that sticks into the flesh of the postcolonial body politic, right? And lingers and hurts. So today I want to talk to you about three such shards. Things stuck lovingly, intimately, painfully into the body politic, I know. Two moments of colonial and one of anti-colonial intimacy that I'm struggling to make sense of. So what I'm going to say to present today is less a finished thesis and more an invitation to a conversation about the sorts of ways in which we can talk, we can narrate, we can weave together these sorts of moments of colonial and anti-colonial intimacy. For ease of exposition, I will call these shards. The first one, New Delhi, October 1984. Second, Gujarat, February, March, April 2002. And then the third one is Telangana, 1948 to 2014. So let me take you through these three moments. October 1984, New Delhi. I remember standing in a small group outside a classroom on the old campus of Jawaharlal Nehru University, where the School of International Studies was then located. We had just learned that Prime Minister Indira Gandhi had been shot by her bodyguards and rushed to a hospital. I don't recall the sequence of events clearly that day, but I do remember going later in the day with a classmate to his house, which was in the same neighborhood as the Prime Minister's. Not much could be seen in terms of activity in the Prime Minister's house, and I don't recall the details of the visit to my friend's house very vividly. But I do remember coming back in a bus, probably the 615, to campus. It was already night and pretty dark outside. What I also remember were small fires, groups of people gathered around on the around these fires on the roads, and some overturned burning scooters. The driver had turned off the lights in the bus by now and was racing through these scenes as if in a hurry to finish his journey and get back to the depot. Even as he turned out the lights, I remember him asking a young Sikh boy who had not stood out before to hide behind the seats. He knew things that were only dimly emerging for me. Just before the IIT Delhi stop, the driver stopped the bus, and the young boy stepped out to what fate I'll never know, but can only shudder to imagine knowing what all happened that night. The bus moved on, and at the very next stop, a group of muscled men barged in. Their faces are hazy in my memory. It was still dark in the bus, but I remember a rod in the hand of the leader and a question laced with abuses, which he barked at the driver. Were there any Sikhs on the bus? This was a moment poised with all sorts of horrible possibilities, and I had an acute sense of my watching mutely, dumbly, from the shadows of the darkly lit bus at this unfolding scene. There were no Sikhs in the bus by this time, and it was allowed to proceed. But the underlying structure of that scene, encasing, among other things, among other features, my dimness, my helplessness, has always haunted me. I have often wondered, what would I have done if those people had barged in one stop earlier? Would we have been able to stop those thugs from harming the boy? Would they have listened to us? I always knew already that this structured scene had been played many a time before in India. If it was not the Sikhs, it was someone else. Muslims, Dalits, South Indians, Northeasterners, Hindus. Our positions were all interchangeable. Where was the state? The state of my nationalist texts on these dark nights and many a time brightly lit days. What was my state? Inside the JNU campus, the faculty, students, and workers were forming committees and taking on the task of guarding the outer perimeter of the campus to prevent any mobs from coming in. There were periodic rumors of this group or that group breaking into the campus to attack Sikhs. I remember one functionary of the student wing of the ruling Congress party saying that he saw no reason why JNU, the campus, should be an island when the whole city was burning. I was glad JNU was an island, one of many in the city. I was deeply appreciative of its intensely political culture and whatever it was about its politics or culture that at that moment made it different. I don't remember much of the next few days except a visit later to a neighborhood where much of the killing and destruction had taken place. But we know now that nearly 3,000 Sikhs were brutally murdered by armed gangs in the next few days while the police stood by and the administration looked on. The independent post-colonial state was devouring its own nationals. I mention all this not because communal riots were unheard of in India. I had grown up around a social science and popular discourse of communalism and frequent communal riots in the country. But my dominant understanding of that was as a lack in the body politic, a disease of traditional Hindus and Muslims that saw them killing each other periodically over various provocations. Hyderabad, the city I grew up in, was no stranger to this logic, having witnessed a number of brutal riots. But many of these riots I'd only seen on paper, that is, read about them. And in almost all the reporting, though, it was never really clear who was being killed or why, since the newspapers followed a convention of not naming individuals or groups. What was apparent, and probably was meant to be apparent, was social disorder. And in almost all cases, the state stepped in, sooner or later, with various measures, army marches, president's rule, the healing touch, and so on. In other words, these riots appeared as a failure of the social or political fabric that a good state, many a time incompetent and slow, but benevolent nevertheless, periodically stepped in to repair. And what followed then were discourses on communal harmony and secularism, or treatises on the socio-economic or political causes of these riots and how to overcome them as progressive citizens. Society was the problem, and the state stepped in to rectify the situation. Our social pathologies, our incomplete modernity, it seemed, required the post-colonial state to teach its nationals how to get along with each other, how to sing together our wanted unity and diversity. But New Delhi 1984 consumed me in a different way. It was in the capital city, New Delhi, not on the periphery of a vast subcontinent outside of the immediate reach of state forces. And the state was deliberately quiet, willing the killings to go on. Worse, the next prime minister, the son of the slain one, seemed to justify the killings by claiming that when a big tree falls, the earth shakes. On one side were the images of the new prime minister in spotless white, standing holding his young son by the funeral pyre of his mother, eyes shaded by dark glasses. On the other side were pictures of grieving Sikhs, mostly women, holding the remains of their loved ones who had been beaten, butchered, and burned to death. This was not the face of an incompetent state, one that takes a while to get its act together, but comes around eventually. This was a deathly state that was coldly competent and calculatingly indifferent to the deaths of its own that it had started willing. This was a state bloated with the knowledge, the organizational ability, and the political will to kill. This was the post-colonial state tearing its own. How does one, raised on the vices of colonialism and the virtues of freedom, nationalism, and independence, relate to that? Writing in The New Yorker about the ghosts of Mrs. Gandhi, Amitav Ghosh, who was also in New Delhi in November 1984, discusses his dilemma about how to even talk about these occurrences. Drawing on the work of the Bosnian writer, Zevad Karahasan, Ghosh wonders about the dangers of focusing the narration on what leaps out at a writer here, which is the violence. The vividness of this violence as what is worthy of narrating appears to be an outcome of what Karahasan sees as the dominant aesthetic of our time, an aesthetic of indifference. Within this aesthetic, all of us, Ghosh argues, have come, following Karahasan, have come to expect the bloody detail or the elegantly staged spectacle for the reader that closes the chapter or affects the climax. While this fits our modern conventions of representation, Ghosh says that this also poses a dilemma for the writer who sees herself as a citizen. Resisting his writer self and the sense of writer's wonder that would otherwise have drawn him to the violence, Ghosh draws on the identity of the citizen and asks, what must be done when the constitutional authority breaks down and the burden of the writer is not as relevant as the burden of the citizen? This is the time, he answers, when he wants to join crowds, even though Ghosh, like V.S. Naipaul, in whose words he finds a resonance, believes that writers typically don't join crowds. The act of joining a crowd, for Ghosh here, implies becoming a part of those significant numbers of people who, in the face of horrifying violence, respond by resisting it through ordinary acts of risk and courage. These ordinary acts are not very dramatic, and so do not invite the gaze of those drawn to write about such events. But they are crucial. They're crucial because in the face of grotesque and brutal violence, they are an affirmation of humanity. Ghosh the citizen appeals to the dangers of a dominant aesthetic of indifference, an aesthetic that leads writers to portray the bloody details of violence while ignoring the undramatic ordinary acts by asking us to turn our gaze to the latter and telling us to look for that in every portrayal from other parts of the world that only emphasizes the violence. As he phrases it, when I now read descriptions of troubled parts of the world in which violence appears primordial and inevitable, a fate to which masses of people are largely resigned, I find myself asking, is that all there was to it? Or is it possible that the authors of these descriptions fail to find a form or a style or a voice of a plot that could accommodate both violence and the civilized willed response to it? I read Ghosh's account as offering a challenge to all of us in international relations who seek to describe, understand, or explain violent events. I see it as pushing us to ask, have we failed to find a form or a style or a voice of a plot that could accommodate both the violence and the civilized willed response to it? I take this seriously, and I admire the ways in which Ghosh's writings deliver on this front. I'm reminded particularly of that passage in An Antique Land, where he writes that it is important in the context of a communal riot of Hindu-Muslim violence to remember that even as this was going on, Muslims saved Hindus and Hindus saved Muslims. It is important because it is through those remembrances that we remain sane. He says, it is the incantation that redeems our sanity. And I'm quoting now from his passage from the book. The stories of those riots are always the same. Tales that grow out of an explosive barrier of symbols, of cities going up in flames because of a cow found dead in a temple or a pig in a mosque, of people killed for wearing a lungi or a dhoti, depending on where they find themselves, of women disemboweled for wearing veils over a million, of men dismembered for the state of their foreskins. I could not have expected them to understand an Indian's terror of symbols. End quote. An Indian's terror of symbols, to understand what it means in a suddenly transformed public space to be reduced to a fragment, to be read off a foreskin or a dot on the face or a knot in your hair. But the question that Ghosh doesn't seem to answer and that I cannot let go of is the issue of the colonial state, that constitutional authority that has broken down. The year 1984 made it clear, if it was not fully clear before, that now the terror was emanating from the state. And Hindus and Sikhs could save each other, but how effective was that in the face of a state that not only appropriated the symbols of the post-colonial nation, but armed itself with all the paraphernalia, voter registration lists, house addresses, ration cards, that allowed it to tag and track insufficiently nationalized bodies in order to hunt and kill. As theorists of the political and the post-colonial, how do we think? How do we come to terms with that state? What responsibility, what burden, obligation, duty, what scholarship falls on us as we try to make sense of that willful transmogrification? What failure of form, what failure of the post-colonial lies here? The program in 1984 fractured the narratives of the incompetent but well-intentioned Indian state that I had inherited. This was not the post-coloniality I had signed on to. The massacre of Sikhs in Delhi in November 1984 remained embedded in my bodily memory, pulsing but not addressed categorically until Gujarat 2002. Gujarat 2002, February, March, April. I was in Poughkeepsie as I followed the events in Gujarat, India, 27th February. The burning of 58 men, women, and children coming back in a train at Godhra in Gujarat. The pogrom against Muslims that was unleashed by the local government after that. The silence and complicity of the central government as the violence continued day after day. The horror stories that were flooding the newspapers every day. The citizens' report that I could barely read then, for so horrifying were the details, so blood-curdling the stories of what was happening once again. I'm quoting now from an account of that period. The next 72 hours were to demonstrate exactly what the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the Hindu fundamentalist party, in Gujarat and at the center had in mind. A program of unimaginable proportions was unleashed with the full sanction of the government. Goons from the RSS, the VHP, and Bajrang Dal were given a free hand by the state authorities and police. Waters lists, again, arms, gas cylinders, and transportation mysteriously became available. Despite Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee cancelling his trip to Australia for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in anticipation of a major outburst of violence, he did nothing to ensure law and order was maintained. The state government delayed asking for the deployment of the army till the evening of 20th February. Even though the troops began arriving in Ahmedabad early on 1st March, lack of logistical cooperation from the local authorities meant they could not be effectively deployed until 3rd March, by which time the worst damage had already been done. By then, over 600 Muslims had been killed. The unofficial death toll today is more than 2,000. More than 200,000 had been displaced because their homes had been looted and burned, and Muslim property worth several thousand crores of rupees destroyed, all under the watchful eye of the police and state administration. End quote. Yes, this was not the only plot or the only storyline. Yes, there were many civilized and willed responses to the violence that affirmed your faith in the humanity of ordinary people. Siddhartha Varadarajan's tribute to Geeta Bain, who was a Hindu woman married to a Muslim person, is one among many of the small acknowledgments of that humanity. But even as the stories of courageous and personally fatal acts by ordinary people such as Geeta Bain rescue my faith in the human, in the revulsion that most ordinary people feel towards brutal acts of violence, I'm still left with the hyper-competence of the post-colonial state, its organized treasury of citizens' identification marks, and its politics of killing to deal with. How do I make sense of its cannibalistic rituals? I start leafing through the books on this program, and repugnance swamps me. I know I'll not be able to read them fully, and I tell myself, maybe a little too forgivingly, what purpose would that serve? But the bloody details become important, for there is a disproportionality there that defies ordinary affirmations of humanity. In the very beginning of one account, there is a report that the Chief Minister of Gujarat at that time, and now Prime Minister of the country, Mr. Narendra Modi, called in his administration officials after the incident at Godhra to tell them to let justice be done for Godhra and to remain inactive during communal disturbances. On state-run television, Mr. Modi is also reported to have said, I want to assure the people that Gujarat shall not tolerate any such incident. He's talking about the burning of the 58 people. The culprits will get full punishment for their sins. Not only this, we will set an example that nobody, not even in his dreams, thinks of committing a heinous crime like this. Later on in the day in the Gujarat Assembly, Mr. Modi re-articulated the sentiment. The state government, taking seriously this cruel and inhuman offense of the mass violence on innocent travelers, is firm to take symbolic steps and to punish in such a way that such an incident may not repeat in the future. The Home Minister of Gujarat, Gordon Zarafian, said, we will teach a lesson to those who have done this. There are those telltale signs, blood portending, gut spilling, encounter to happen, details, punishment in such a way that it won't happen again, making examples, teaching a lesson, justice. Let justice be done. Let justice be done in such a style that unjust and heinous crimes will never be committed again. What is the relationship between teaching lessons, dealing in death, and justice being done? What is the politics of killing citizens, citizen death here? Is it how to effectively teach one section of its citizenry such that others learn their lessons properly? Ghosh asks, have we failed to find a form or a style or a voice of a plot that could accommodate both violence and the civilized willed response to it? Could we redirect that question at our understandings of the Indian post-colonial state and ask, have we, decades after independence, failed to find a form or a style or a voice of a plot that allows a more humane and accommodating relation between the state, its citizenry, and very basic ideas of justice? Or have we lost the plot, the post-colonial storyline, altogether? Is it only a sanitizing, soul-deafening, insane incantation now? I want to turn briefly to the third moment, which is a slightly less depressing moment, which has to do with this particular social movement in South India called Telangana. And Telangana is a it was a region of a particular linguistic state where there was an armed communist struggle in 1948, and then there are various sorts of ups and downs in this movement. And the struggle was basically for local autonomy from another linguistic group. And the whole idea was that this other group, though they spoke the same language, was essentially treating them as colonized citizens and was exploiting them both in more or less a colonial fashion. So what struck me was this language of coloniality that is used inside the nation state by one group who typically are sought to be produced as brothers by this other linguistic group. Savage Telangana. Telangana is a word, a world, and bodies in emotion. It is a vernacular world that lies in the shadows of the post-colonial scholar's orbits. It is difficult to enter that world through the Indian post-colonial's English or through her languages of liberal politics. English tends to flatten that world, as does the scholarly prose of modern economics and politics. As Dilip Menon, drawing on Vivek Dareshwar, points out, and I quote, "The desire of the Indian post-colonial elite to be modern has worked within the progressive narrative of liberal humanism. Self-fashioning is the result of a jettisoning of ethnic, linguistic, caste, and other markers to attain the abstract identity of the individual citizen. To this end, the post-colonial elite in India has used English both as a language, as much as a semiotic system symbolizing modernity to impose their secular categories on the social world. This modern subjectivity framed in English has allowed caste to be approached only at one remove, as something restricted to the private domain, suffused with the vernacular. English has acted as a meta-language with references to caste and other traditional practices. Those who appropriate English claim a subject position free from these sorts of particular markings. The public sphere is narrowly constructed as the sphere governed by secular categories." That's the quote from Dilip Menon. Telangana teaches you that the Indian post-colonial's limitations in seeing the local in the local may be the limits of encounters framed solely through the mediation of English. Moving beyond English, knowing Telugu, the local language, gets you a seat at the window, but you're still an outsider. And if you speak your Telugu properly, probably the consummate outsider, because there are multiple Telugus, and their mutual encounters are politically and culturally and economically charged affairs. On eTelangana, one of the sites devoted to Telangana on the blogosphere, there is a list that identifies words in Telangana Telugu and their equivalents in Andhra Telugu to work with an encounter between different types of Telugu. Nilu in Telangana Telugu is Niru in Andhra Telugu, it informs us. There is no third term, water, mediating this encounter in the list. Nor is there, as Deepesh Chakrabarty might want us to be alert to, a seemingly transcendent H2O claiming to be a real and superior definition of both. This is an internecine dispute that involves multiple translations among life worlds. And the culture, politics, and economy of water is central in many ways to this battle, from whether you say Niru or Nilu, to where it comes from, how it is channeled, and where it is made to flow or not flow. I entered the world of Telangana from the lowest possible level, the roughest form of language, vulgarity. When I first heard one of the political leaders of Telangana, K. Chandrasekhar Rao, or as he's known as KCR locally, laying out the distinctions between vulgarities in Telangana Telugu and in Andhra Telugu, when I first saw it on YouTube, I was appalled and delighted at the same time. He had been accused of using unparliamentary language and holding a press conference on the nuanced distinctions between our vulgarities and their vulgarities was his unabashed response. There was more politics in that response, in the form of that response, than I had come to expect from the Andhra Pradesh Legislative Assembly, though it was not for want of vulgarity in other respects. That lesson from KCR in distinguishing comparative vulgarities was liberating. It was a refreshingly powerful call against the insidious sacralization of multiple hierarchies. In the battle between Nilu and Niru, this was a reduction of the high and mighty, an equalization of Niru's historical attempt to assert not just a difference, but also a hierarchy between the various Telugus, between their Telugu as the standard and the pure, and our Telugu as the deviant and the lack. But that brief excursus into comparative vulgarities, that diminishing to the common, to the ordinary, to the people, brought both terms down to the popular and more equal grounds. This was the reconstitution of an us and a them that would productively demean both. Vulgarity in this more archaic sense also came alive in the Telangana movement and brought hundreds of common people, characterized as lacking taste, culture, education, and other such refinements, onto the streets and into the public, chanting, singing, and dancing. Telangana, Telangana, Telangana. Politics made sense and was now public and accessible to the vulgar. You could speak without shame in public as you normally spoke in your private realms. Nilu, Nilu, Nilu. If the dominant form of globalization in Andhra Pradesh was from very early on about privatization, about the enclosure of that which was common, the appropriation of water, land, minerals, then the Telangana movement was a very vulgar rejection of that refined culture, a rejection by the common and ordinary of all those high-walled enclosures. It was about a restaking of claims to the commons, a taking back of language, land, water, culture, history, politics, and the state. Split the state in order to renew a claim to the commons. Reject the dominance of a cultural identity in order to resituate oneself in the emerging political economy. Other hitherto private acts spilled onto the public realm. Cooking was no longer a private act as the kitchens came out into the streets. It was called Vanta Varpu. July 2011 saw some Vanta Varpu. On such days, large numbers of people trooped into public spaces with their kitchen utensils and cooked and ate together. Newsprint in Hyderabad, increasingly devoted to which model or socialite was coming or going out of which nightclub, had to waste itself showing images of common, ordinary activists cooking and feasting on the roads quite unglamorously. And they looked indecently happy. Telangana as a word and a world in motion could be discerned in the shadows, seen if you could find your way through the vulgar vernacular. But to the English-speaking, Indian post-colonial, and the high-cultured Telugu, this was a betrayal of the new light dawning on Hyderabad and on Andhra Pradesh. Poetic form. A word in motion, aesthetic motion, gathers a lot of politics. It generates a momentum that can destabilize existing fixities. Listening to the debates on Telangana, it is fascinating to see what fixities, what materialities this roiling word Telangana unsettles. Professor Kodan Ram, an important advocate of the movement and a teacher of political science at Usmania University and one of the main forces behind this movement, before the latest phase of the struggle, speaks about how repressive the political climate was in rural Telangana. In a speech to the Telangana Educationist Forum, and one of the features of this movement was that the academics and the educationists, from school teachers to professors in universities, were very, very actively involved, along with a whole bunch of workers from in various sorts of cultural spheres. In a speech to the Telangana Educationist Forum, he talks about how around 2004, people in Telangana villages were simply not in a position to even discuss publicly with each other their shared problems. That ordinary act required a lot of courage. Whenever they met as part of the Human Rights Forum and civil liberties organizations to discuss how people in Telangana villages responded to their efforts to gather facts about encounters, and encounters are essentially staged killings by the police. So the if the police decide that somebody needs to be finished, they'll take them, they'll arrest them, take them out into the woods or something, execute them basically, then come back and put forward a story about how these people were shot while they were trying to escape and resisted being captured. So when the human rights forums would go into the countryside to interview people about these encounters to find out the facts and to say, I mean, why was so-and-so killed? What happened? Could you tell us the details? Nobody would be interested in talking to them because they were so scared that any conversation with any of these human rights activists would make them suspect. So even when people killed in encounters were really close to them, possibly even their relatives, those directly affected though they were clearly full of sorrow, would pretend not to know what had happened. I believe that some police came, there was some disturbance, and some people died, but I don't really know, since on that day I had gone to my in-laws. But you can talk to him, sir. And they would point to the person next to them, who would in turn perform the same charade. That's very true, sir. He wasn't there, but I wasn't there either. I had to go to the market for some work. But you should ask this fellow. He would then show the third person as a potential witness, who would in turn say, I wasn't there either. I had to go to the hospital because my kid was not well. Everyone knew what had occurred. Everyone understood. But everyone also understood that they should not talk about it. The fear of state reprisal was so intense that you could be traveling in a bus or train and people would talk sympathetically to you about this or that all the way through, but only when they were getting off would they whisper their true opinions on a troubling issue. That was the nature of the repressive silence in Telangana in as recently as 2004. What this repressive atmosphere in which talk about human rights violations took place in banal generalities meant was that any public comment about seemingly domestic, personal, or civil society issues, such as dowry debts or electricity bills, was difficult because those complaints were likely to be read as superficial symptoms, emblematic signs of another more radical revolutionary politics. Are you a Naxalite? Are you being instigated by others as a way of generating unrest? In this context, Professor Kodandaram narrates an incident where after discussing a set of issues concerning the injustice done to Telangana, the people who had gathered agreed to form a local committee to take up only the very specific issue of why there was no hospital in their town, and were going to call it the People's Committee of Telangana, when one of the participants seemed startled and said, "Everything is very good, sir, but why are you saying people again? They will call us a part of the People's War Group and beat us." Marking something as a people's committee, invoking the name of the people, discussing issues concerning common problems, were likely to be meant trouble with the state authorities. Such discursive actions were likely to be read as a front, as only a cover for a more insidious revolutionary politics, and likely therefore to invite too close and repressive an attention in the form of harassment, beatings, and lockups from the local administration. But even in a changed situation, in which, after a lot of political mobilization, the silence had been disrupted, and it was possible to discuss publicly various issues regarding Telangana, Professor Kodandaram would argue that it was crucial to be vigilant because the situation could change any time. It was also crucial that protest actions be vigilantly nonviolent, since a colonial administration, and they used the term very explicitly that this was a colonial administration, ruled through violence and repression and would use any violence on the protesters' part as an excuse to brutally suppress the movement. Drawing explicitly on Fanon's characterization of the nature of a colonial regime and characterizing the ruling regime in this part of, in the state as a settler colonial one, Professor Kodandaram argued the importance of working democratically and within the existing parameters to take this particular social movement forward. Listening to him articulate this position, one sees how the Telangana movement's political practices had to not only break through a blanket of silence and banal generalities, but also stop short of any violent manifestation, even if the violence was of a reactive sort to structural oppression. If politics has to be framed within these limits, if they have to perform and persuade vast collectivities within these parameters, then words have to be in very creative motion. Words must sing, words must dance, words must make you sing and dance and thus persuade and compel an imaginative change in the cartographic borders that currently limit the imagination of millions of people. Words in motion are thus charged with the ethical responsibility of redrawing existing borders within a nation state. Granted, these redrawings are not as politically contentious as the sovereign borders of an existing nation state. Granted that in a constitutional setup like India's, they're even legitimized through the law. And yet, such an encounter must rework culture, must rework political economy, and must rework long-standing wounds brought about by wealth creation or its neglect without necessarily creating new ones. It is not surprising then that the second most important word that seemed to come often from the lips of the movements is spandana, which means response, reaction, vibration. So what is the sort of a feeling that words would evoke? It is almost as if the movement believed that its words in motion would generate a political reaction, a response, a vibration in the others around, that would yield a new map, a new locale of freshly imagined possibilities. But that presumes that those around would hear the song of the region and be intrigued enough to do their homework, do enough work on the state of their home to be able to respond ethically outside of banal generalities of violent suppression. Who sings and who is tuned in then? How do the songs of the region resonate or not with the song of the post-colonial state? So those are the sorts of three movements that I wanted to talk about, and then in many ways sort of pull back to raise two particular issues, two specific issues in terms of how to think then about worlding the post-colonial. The first, essentially, as I pull back from these sorts of three moments of two moments of colonial and one moment of anti-colonial intimacy, to say, what are the emerging imaginaries of new colonialisms that are reshaping the horizon of contemporary politics, right? As we explore these sorts of specific moments of intimacy, what are the sorts of colonialisms, new forms that we see? And I raise this partly because, just like the post-colonials, colonialism also adapts to its opposition, right? The empires of yesterday are not the empires of tomorrow. Colonialism does not emerge only from one script. It also plans, it has its seminars, it has its meetings, and it sort of produces its own new sorts of imaginations of how to colonize the world, to put it very crudely. So it is important to address that question frontally and to sort of, in that way, find a way to share moments of these sorts of intimacies across. And I say this particularly because Mr. Modi, who was the Chief Minister of Gujarat, where the anti-Muslim riots happened, not only was elected three times to 3 5-year terms democratically, but then was elected nationally, right? So he's now the Prime Minister of India. And no amount of strictures from the court or various sorts of things have been able to, in some ways, delegitimize. The main opposition to him, the Congress, cannot really take him on because it is guilty of 1984. Right, so they cannot engage each other, and they cannot problematize each other. The United States government, which had initially refused a visa to Modi for his involvement in the Gujarat riots for almost 10 years or something, once they realized that he was becoming politically very successful, withdrew that. So that the illegitimacy that attached to him at one point was progressively withdrawn by the EU, by the United States, by all sorts of people, because they're like, okay, this guy's good for business in many ways, right? So do we really care about these sorts of things? So what are the forms, what are the sorts of ways in which seemingly local colonial moments like this get woven together into a broader colonial imaginary where someone like this could be the leader of a modern democratic state? And two, something that follows from this particular question, which is, against this context, what are the other imaginaries? What are the ways in which other life worlds, right, other ways of thinking about the world, other decolonial, anti-colonial life worlds are fighting or carrying on a certain sort of a battle against these new colonialisms, right? How are they visible? Like, for me, what was always very interesting in terms of Telangana was I'd never seen such intense political engagement at a subaltern vernacular level. And yet, that was visible, that was not visible to, let's say, friends of mine who were from the same region, but who might not have known this local subaltern language, right? So my friends, as I was telling John over coffee, were more interested in Tunisia, in Egypt, and where every other day there was a post, Facebook posting about those sorts of places, but they couldn't see what was happening politically right under their noses, right? So the invisibility of certain very active political struggles, which finally became successful in 2014 with the achievement of a separate Indian state, separate state within the Indian Union, and our capacity to read those sorts of struggles and write them into our understanding of the international system. So I'd like to leave you with two questions, basically. How is the world being produced colonially? And what does it mean to, and what are the ways in which people are reworlding it, remaking it anti-colonially? And how do we find a way to read both? Thank you.